When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The first opinion given to me regarding Jacob Settle was a simple, descriptive statement. He's a down-in-the-mouth chap. But I found that it embodied the thoughts and ideas of all his fellow workmen. There was, in the phrase, a certain easy tolerance, an absence of positive feeling of any kind, rather than any complete opinion which marked pretty accurately the man's place in public esteem. Still, there was some dissimilarity between this and his appearance, which unconsciously set me thinking, and by degrees, as I saw more of the place and the workmen, I came to have special interest in him. He was, I found, forever doing kindnesses, not involving money expenses beyond his humble means, but in the manifold ways of forethought and forbearance and self-repression, which are the truer charities of life. Women and children trusted him implicitly, though strangely enough, he rather shunned them, except when anyone was sick, and then he made his appearance to help if he could, timidly and awkwardly. He led a very solitary life, keeping house by himself in a tiny college, or rather hut, of one room far on the edge of Moorland. His existence seemed so sad and solitary that I wished to cheer it up, and for the purpose took the occasion when we had both been sitting up with a child, injured by me through accident, to offer to lend him books. He gladly accepted, and as we parted in the gray of dawn, I felt that something of mutual confidence had been established between us. The books were always most carefully and punctually returned, and in time, Jacob Settle and I became quite friends. Once or twice, as I crossed the moorland on Sundays, I looked in on him, but on such occasions he was shy and ill at ease, so I felt that diffident about calling to see him. He would never, under any circumstances, come into my own lodgings. One Sunday afternoon, I was coming back from a long walk beyond the moor, and I passed Settle's college, stooped at the door to say hello, how do you do, to him. As the door was shut, I thought that he was out, and merely knocked for form's sake, or through habit, not expecting to get any answer. To my surprise, I heard a feeble voice from within, though what was said I could not hear. I entered at once and found Jacob laying half-dressed upon his bed. He was as pale as death, and the sweat was simply rolling off his face. His hands were unconsciously gripping the bedclothes as a drowning man holds on to whatever he may grasp. As I came in, he half arose with a wild, haunted look in his eyes, which were wide open and staring as though something of horror had come before him. But when he recognized me, he sank back on the couch with a smothered sob of relief and closed his eyes. I stood by him for a while, quite a minute or two, while he gasped. Then he opened his eyes and looked at me, but with such a despairing, woeful expression that, as I am a living man, I would have rather seen that frozen look of horror. I sat down beside him and asked after his health. For a while, he would not answer me except to say that he was not ill, but then, after scrutinizing me closely, he half arose on his elbow and said, "I thank you kindly, sir, but I'm simply telling you the truth. I am not ill, as men call it, though God knows whether there be not worse sicknesses than doctors know of. I'll tell you, as you are so kind, but I trust that you won't even mention such a thing to a living soul, for it might work me more greater woe. I'm suffering from a bad dream." "A bad dream," I said, hoping to cheer him up. "But dreams pass away with the light, even with walking." There I stopped, for before he spoke, I saw the answer in his desolate look round the little place. "No, no, that's all well for people that live in comfort and with those they love around them. It is 1,000 times worse for those who live alone and have to do so. What cheer is there for me, waking here in the silence of the night with the wide moon around me, full of voices and full of faces that make my waking a worse dream than my sleep? Young sir, you have no past that can send its legions to people the darkness and the empty space, and I pray the good God that you may never have. As he spoke, there was such an almost irresistible gravity of conviction in his manner that I abandoned my remonstrance? As he spoke, there was such an almost irresistible gravity of conviction in his manner that I abandoned my remonstrance about his solitary life. I felt that I was in the presence of some secret influence which I could not fathom. To my relief, for I knew not what to say, he went on. 2 nights passed, I have dreamed it. It was hard enough the first night, but I came through it. Last night the exception was in itself almost worse than the dream, until the dream came, and then it swept away every remembrance of lesser pain. I stayed awake till just before the dawn, and then it came again, and ever since I've been in such an agony as I am sure the dying feel, and with it all of the dread of tonight. Before he got to the end of the sentence, my mind was made up, and I felt that I could speak to him more cheerfully. Try to get to sleep early tonight, in fact, before the evening has passed away. The sleep will refresh you, and I promise you there will not be any bad dreams after tonight. He shook his head hopelessly, so I sat a little longer and then left him. When I got home, I made my arrangements for the night, for I had made up my mind to share Jacob Settle's lonely vigil in his cottage on the moor. I judged that if he got to sleep before sunset, he would wake well before midnight, and so, just as the bells of the city were striking 11, I stood opposite his door, armed with a bag in which were my supper, an extra-large flask, a couple of candles, and a book. The moonlight was bright and flooded the whole moor till it was almost as light as day, but ever and anon black clouds drove across the sky and made a darkness which, by comparison, seemed almost tangible. I opened the door softly and entered without waking Jacob, who lay asleep with his white face upward. He was still, and again bathed in sweat. I tried to imagine what visions were passing before those closed eyes, which could bring them the misery and woe which were stamped on the face, but fancy failed me, and I waited for the awakening. It came suddenly, and in a fashion which touched me to the quick, for the hollow groan that broke from the man's white lips as he half arose and sank back was manifestly the realization or completion of some train of thought which had gone before. If this be dreaming, I said to myself, then it must be based on some very terrible reality. What can have been that unhappy fact that he spoke of? While I thus spoke, he realized that I was with him. It struck me as strange that he had no period of that doubt as to whether dream or reality surrounded him, which commonly marks an expected environment of waking men. With a positive cry of joy, he seized my hand and held it in his two wet, trembling hands as a frightened child clings to someone whom it loves. I tried to soothe him. "There, there. It's all right. I've come to stay with you tonight, and together we will try to fight this evil dream." He let go of my hand suddenly and sank back into his bed and covered his eyes with his hands.
"Fight it? The evil dream?"
"No, sir, no. No mortal power can fight that dream, for it comes from God. It is burned in here." And he beat upon his forehead, then went on. "It is the same dream, ever the same, and yet it grows in its power to torture me every time it comes." "What is the dream?" I asked, thinking that speaking of it might give him some relief, but he shrank away from me and after a long pause said, "No, I'd better not tell it. It may not come again." There was manifestly something to conceal from me, something that lay behind the dream, so I answered, "All right. I hope you've seen the last of it. But if it should come again, you will tell me, will you not? I ask you not out of curiosity, but because I think it may relieve you to speak." He answered with what I thought was almost an undue amount of solemnity. "If it comes again, I shall tell you all." Then I tried to get his mind away from the subject to more mundane things, so I produced supper and made him share it with me, including the contents of the flask. After a little, he braced up, and when I lit my cigar, having given him another, we smoked a full hour and talked of many things. Little by little, the comfort of his body stole over his mind, and I could see sleep laying her gentle hands on his eyelids. He felt it, too, and told me that now he felt all right, and I might safely leave him. But I told him that, right or wrong, I was going to see in the daylight. So I lit another candle and began to read as he fell asleep. By degrees, I got interested in my book, so interested that presently I was startled by its dropping out of my hands. I looked and saw that Jacob was still asleep, and I was rejoiced to see that there was on his face a look of unwittoned happiness, while his lips seemed to move with unspoken words. Then I turned to my work again, and again woke, but this time to feel chilled to my very marrow by hearing the voice from the bed beside me. "Not with those red hands! Never, never!" On looking at him, I found that he was still asleep. He woke, however, in an instant, and did not seem surprised to see me. There was again that strange apathy to his surroundings. And then I said, "Settle, tell me your dream. You may speak freely, for I shall hold your confidence sacred. While we both live, I shall never mention what you may choose to tell me." I said I would, but I'd better tell you first what goes before the dream, that you may understand. I was a schoolmaster when I was a very young man. It was only a parish school in a little village in the West Country. No need to mention any names. Better not. I was engaged to be married to a young girl whom I loved and almost reverenced. It was the old story. While we were waiting for the time when we could afford to set up house together, another man came along. He was nearly as young as I was, and handsome and a gentleman, with all a gentleman's attractive ways for a woman of our class. He would go fishing, and she would meet him while I was at my work in school. I reasoned with her and employed her to give him up. I offered to get married at once and go away and begin the world in a strange country, but she would not listen to anything I could say, and I could see that she was infatuated with him. Then I took it on myself to meet the man and ask him to deal well with the girl, for I thought he might mean honesty by her, so that there might be no talk or chance of talk on the part of others. I went there. I should meet him with none by, and we met. Here Jacob Settle had to pause, for something seemed to rise in his throat, and he almost gasped for breath. Then he went on. "Sir, as God is above us, there was no selfish thought in my heart that day. I loved my pretty Mabel too well to contend with a part of her love, and I thought of my own unhappiness too often not to have come to realize whatever might come to her, my hope was gone." He was insolent to me. You, sir, who are a gentleman, cannot know, perhaps, how galling can be the insolence of one who is above you in station. But I bore with that. I implored him to deal well with the girl, for what might be only a pastime of an idle hour with him might be the breaking of her heart. For I never had a thought of her truth, or that the worst of harm could come to her. It was only the unhappiness to her heart I feared. But when I asked him when he intended to marry her, his laughter galled me so that I lost my temper and told him that I would not stand by and see her life made unhappy. And then he grew angry too, and in his anger said such cruel things of her that then and there I swore he should not live to do her harm. God knows how it came about, for in such moments of passion, it is hard to remember the steps from a word to a blow, but I found myself standing over his dead body with my hands crimson with the blood that welled from his torn throat. We were alone, and he was a stranger with none of his kin to seek for him, and murder does not always out, not all at once. His bones may be whitening still, for all I know, in the pool of the river where I left him. No one suspected his absence or why it was, except my poor Mabel. She dared not speak. but it was all in vain. For when I came back again, after an absence of months, for I could not live in the place, I learned that her shame had come and that she had died in it. Hitherto I had been borne up by the thought that my ill deed had saved her future, but now, when I learned that I had been too late, and that my poor love was smirched with that man's sin, I fled away, the sense of my useless guilt upon me more heavily than I could bear. Sir, you that have not done such a sin don't know what it is to carry it with you. You may think that custom makes it easy to you, but it is not so. It grows and grows with every hour, till it becomes intolerable, and with it growing too, the feeling that you must forever stand outside heaven. You don't know what that means, and I pray God that you never may. Ordinary men to whom all things are possible don't often, if ever, think of heaven. It is a name and nothing more, and they're content to wait and let things be, but to those who are doomed to be shut out forever, you cannot think what it means. You cannot guess or measure the terrible, endless longing to see the gates opened and to be able to join the white figures within. And this brings me to my dream. It seemed that the portal was before me, with the great gates of massive steel, with bars of thickness of a mast, rising to the very clouds, and so close that between them was just a glimpse of a crystal grotto, on whose shining walls were figured many white-clad forms with faces radiant with joy. When I stood before the gate, my heart and soul were so full of rapture and longing that I forgot. And there I stood at the gate, two mighty angels with sweeping wings and, oh, so stern of countenance. They held each in one hand a flaming sword, and in the other a latchet, which moved to and fro at their lightest touch. Nearer were figures all draped in black, with the heads covered so that only the eyes were seen, and they handed to each who came white garments such as the angels wear. A low murmur came that told that all should put on their own robes and without soil, or the angels would not pass them in, but would smite them down with their flaming swords. I was eager to don my own garment, and hurriedly threw it over me and stepped swiftly to the gate, but I moved not, and the angels, loosing the latchet, pointed to my dress. I looked down and was aghast, for the whole robe was smeared with blood. My hands were red. They glittered with the blood that dripped from them, as on that day at the riverbank. And then the angels raised their flaming swords to smite me down, and the horror was complete. I awoke. Again, and again, and again, that awful dream comes to me. I never learn from the experience, I never remember, but at the beginning the hope is ever there to make the end more appalling. And I know that the dream does not come true out of the common darkness where the dreams abide, but that it is sent from God as a punishment. Never, never shall I be able to pass the gate, for the soil on the angel garments must ever come from these bloody hands. I listened in a spell as Jacob Settle spoke. There was something so far away in his tone of voice, something so dreamy and mystic in the eyes that looked as if through me at some spirit beyond, something so lofty in his very diction and in such marked contrast to his work-worn clothes and his poor surroundings that I'd wondered if the whole thing were not a dream. We were both silent for a long time. I kept looking at the man before me in growing wonderment. Now that his confession had been made, his soul, which had been crushed to the very earth, seemed to leap back again to uprightness with some resilient force. I suppose I ought to have been horrified with his story, but strange to say, I was not. It certainly is not pleasant to be made the recipient of the confidence of a murderer, but this poor fellow seemed to have had not only so much provocation, but so much self-denying purpose in his deed of blood that I did not feel called upon to pass judgment upon him. My purpose was to comfort, so I spoke with what calmness I could find, for my heart was beating fast and heavily. You need not despair, Jacob Settle. God is very good, and his mercy is great. Live on and work on in the hope that someday you may feel that you have atoned for the past. Here I paused, for I could see that sleep, natural sleep this time, was creeping upon him. Go to sleep, I said. I shall watch with you here, and we shall have no more evil dreams tonight. He made an effort to pull himself together and answered, I don't know how to thank you for your goodness to me this night, but I think you'd best leave me now. I'll try and sleep this out. I feel the weight off my mind since I've told you all. If there's anything of this man left in me, I must try and fight out alone. I'll go tonight, as you wish it, I said, but take my advice and do not live in such a solitary way. Go among men and women, live among them. Share their joys and sorrows, and it will help you to forget. This solitude will make you melancholy mad. I will, he answered, half unconsciously, for sleep was overmastering him. I turned to go, and he looked after me. When I touched the latch, I dropped it, and coming back to the bed, held out my hand. He grasped it with both as he rose to a sitting posture, and I said my good night, trying to cheer him. Heart, man, heart. There is work in the world for you to do, Jacob Settle. You can wear those white robes yet and pass through the gates of steel. Then I left him. A week after, I found his cottage deserted, and on asking the works was told that he'd gone north, no one exactly knew whither. 2 years afterwards, I was staying for a few days with my friend Dr. Munro in Glasgow. He was a busy man and could not spare much time for going about with me, so I spent my days in excursions to the Trossach and Loch Katrine and down the Clyde. On the second last evening of my stay, I came back somewhat later than I'd arranged, but found that my host was late too. The maid told me that he had been sent to the hospital, a case of accident at the gasworks, and the dinner was postponed an hour. So telling her I would stroll down to find her master and walk back with him, I went out. At the hospital, I found him washing his hands, preparatory to starting for home. Casually, I asked him what his case was. Oh, the usual thing. A rotten rope and men's lives of no account. Two men were working in a gasometer when the rope that held their scaffolding broke. It must have occurred just before the diner hour, for no one noticed their absence till the men had returned. There was about 7 feet of water in the gasometer, so they had a hard fight for it, poor fellows. However, one of them is alive. Just alive, but we have had a hard job to pull him through. It seems that he owes his life to his mate, for I've never heard of a greater heroism. They swam together while their strength lasted, but at the end they were so done up that even the lights above and the men slung with ropes coming down to help them could not keep them up. But one of them stood at the bottom and held up his comrade over his head, and those few breaths made all the difference between life and death. They were a shocking sight when they were taken out, for that water is like a purple dye with the gas and tar. The man upstairs looked as if he'd been washed in blood. Ugh. And the other? Oh, he's worse still. But he must have been a very noble fellow. That struggle under the water must have been fearful. One can see by the way the blood has been drawn from the extremities. It makes the idea of the stigmata possible to look at him. Resolution like this could, you would think, do anything in the world. Hey, it might also unbar the gates of heaven. Look here, old man. It is not a very pleasant sight, especially just before dinner, but you are a writer and this is an odd case. Here is something you would not like to miss, for in all human probability you will never see anything like it again. While he was speaking, he brought me into the mortuary of the hospital. On the bier laid a body covered with a white sheet, which was wrapped close around it. Looks like a chrysalis, don't it? I say, Jack, if there be anything in the old myth that a soul is typified by a butterfly, well, then the one that this chrysalis sent forth was a very noble specimen and took all the sunlight on its wings. See here. He uncovered the face. Horrible indeed it looked, so stained with blood. But I knew him at once. Jacob Settle. My friend pulled the winding sheet further down. The hands were crossed on the purple breast as they'd been reverently placed by some tender-hearted person. As I saw them, my heart throbbed with great exultation, for the memory of his harrowing dream rushed across my mind. There was no stain now on those poor brave hands, for they were blanched white as snow. And somehow, as I looked, I felt that the evil dream was all over. That noble soul had won a way through the gate at last. The white rope had now no stain from the hands that had put it on. Every night in the year, four of us sat in the small parlor of the George at Debenham, the undertaker and the landlord and Fetz and myself. Sometimes there would be more, but blow high, blow low, come rain or snow or frost, we four would each be planted in his own particular armchair. Fetz was an old drunken Scotchman, a man of education, obviously, and a man of some property since he lived in idleness. He'd come to Debenham years ago, while still young, and by a mere continuance of living had grown to be an adopted townsman. His blue camlet cloak wore a local antiquity like the church spire. His place in the parlor at the George, his absence from church, his old, crapulous, disreputable vices were all things of course in Debenham. He had some vague, radical opinions and some fleeting infidelities which he would now and again set forth and emphasize with tottering slaps upon the table. He drank rum, 5 glasses regularly every evening, and for the greater portion of his nightly visit to the George, sat with his glasses in his right hand in a state of melancholy alcoholic saturation. We called on the doctor, for he was supposed to have some special knowledge of medicine, and had been known, upon a pinch, to set a fracture or reduce a dislocation. But beyond these slight particulars, we had no knowledge of his character and antecedents. One dark winter night, it had struck 9 some time before the landlord joined us. There was a sick man in the George, a great neighboring profiteer suddenly struck down with apoplexy on his way to Parliament. And the great man's still greater London doctor had been telegraphed to his bedside. It was the first time such a thing had happened in Debenham, for the railway was but newly open, and we were all proportionately moved by the occurrence. "He's come," said the landlord after he filled and lighted his pipe. "He?" said I. "Who? Not the doctor?" "Himself," replied our host. "What is his name?" "Dr. McFarlane," said the landlord. Fetz was far through his third number, stupidly fuddled, now nodding over, now staring mazily around him. But at the last word he seemed to awaken and repeated the name McFarlane 2 times, quietly enough the first time, but with a sudden emotion at the second. "Yes," said the landlord, "that's his name. Dr. Wolf McFarlane." Fetz became instantly sober. His eyes awoke. His voice became clear, loud, and steady. His language forcible and earnest. We were all startled by the transformation, as if a man had risen from the dead. "I beg your pardon," he said. "I'm afraid I've not been paying much attention to your talk. Who is this Wolf McFarlane?" And then, when he had heard the landlord out, "It cannot be, it cannot be," he added. "And yet I would like well to see him face to face." "Do you know him, doctor?" asked the undertaker with a gasp. "God forbid," was the reply. "And yet the name is a strange one. It were too much too fancy to. Tell me, landlord, is he old?" "Well," said the host, "he's not a young man, to be sure, and his hair is white. But he looks younger than you." "He is older, though. Years older. But," with a slap upon the table, "it's the rum you see in my face. Rum and sin. This man perhaps may have an easy conscience and a good digestion. Conscience, hear me speak. You would think I was some good old decent Christian, would you not? But no, not I. I never canted. Voltaire might have canted if he'd stood in my shoes, but the brains, with the rattling Philip on his bald head, the brains were clear and active, and I saw and made no deductions. If you know this doctor, I ventured to remark after a somewhat awful pause, I should gather that you do not share the landlord's good opinion. Fence paid no regard to me. Yes, he said with sudden decision, I must see him face to face. There was another pause, and then a door was closed rather sharply on the first floor, and a stamp was heard upon the stair. That's the doctor, cried the landlord. Look sharp and you can catch him. It was but two steps from the small parlor to the door of the Old George Inn. The wide oak staircase landed almost in the street. There was room for a turkey rug and nothing more between the threshold and the last round of the descent. But this little space was every evening brilliantly lit up, not only by the light upon the stair and the great signal lamp below the sign, but by the warm radiance of the barroom window. The George thus brightly advertised itself to passers-by in the cold street. Fats walked steadily to the spot, and we, who were hanging behind, beheld the two men meet, as one of them had phrased it, face to face. Dr. McFarlane was alert and vigorous. His white hair set off his pale and placid, although energetic, countenance. He was richly dressed in the finest of broadcloth and the whitest of linen, with a great gold watch chain and studs and spectacles of the same precious material. He wore a broad folded tie, white and speckled with lilac, and he carried on his arm a comfortable driving coat of fur. There was no doubt that he became his years breathing, as he did, of wealth and consideration, and it was a surprising contrast to see our parlor sot, bald, dirty, pimpled, and robbed in his old camlet cloak, confront him at the bottom of the stairs. McFarlane, he said somewhat loudly, more like a herald than a friend. The great doctor pulled up short on the fourth step, as though the familiarity of the address surprised and somewhat shocked his dignity. Toddy McFarlane, repeated Fetz. The London man almost staggered. He stared for the swiftest of seconds at the man before him, glanced behind him with a sort of scare, and then in a startled whisper, "Fetz," he said. "You." "Hey," said the brother, "me. Did you think I was dead too? We're not so easy to shut off our acquaintance." "Hush, hush," exclaimed the doctor. "Hush, hush. This meeting is so unexpected. I can see you are unmanned. I hardly knew you, I confess, at first, but I'm overjoyed to have this opportunity. For the president must be how do you do and goodbye in one, for my fly is waiting, and I must not fail the train. But you shall, let me see, yes, you shall give me your address, and can count on early news of me. We must do something for you, Fitz. I fear you are out at elbows, but we must see to that for auld lang syne, as once we sang at suppers." "Money," cried Fetz. "Money from you. The money that I had from you is lying where I cast it in the rain." Dr. McFarlane had talked himself into some measure of superiority and confidence, but the uncommon energy of this refusal cast him back into his first confusion. A horrible, ugly look came and went across his almost venerable countenance. "My dear fellow," he said, "be it as you please. My last thought is to offend you. I would intrude on none. I will leave you my address, however." "I do not wish it. I do not wish to know the roof that shelters you," interrupted the other. "I heard your name. I feared it might be you. I wish to know if, after all, there were a God. I now know that there is none. Be gone." He still stood in the middle of the rug between the stair and the doorway, and the great London physician, in order to escape, would be forced to step to one side. It was plain that he hesitated before the thought of this humiliation. White as he was, there was a dangerous glitter in his spectacles. But while he still paused uncertain, he became aware that the driver of his fly was peering in from the street at this unusual scene, and caught a glimpse at the same time of our little body from the parlor, huddled by the corner of the bar. The presence of so many witnesses decided him at once to flee. He crouched together, brushing on the wainscot, and made a dart like a serpent striking for the door. But his tribulation was not yet entirely at an end, for even as he was passing, Fetz clutched him by the arm, and these words came in a whisper and yet painfully distinct. "Have you seen it again?" The great rich London doctor cried out aloud with a sharp, throttling cry. He dashed his questioner across the open space and, with his hands over his head, fled out of the door like a detected thief. Before it had occurred to one of us to make a movement, the fly was already rattling toward the station. The scene was over like a dream, but the dream had left proofs and traces of its passage. Next day, the servant found the fine gold spectacles broken on the threshold, and that very night we were all standing breathless by the barroom window, and Fetz at our side, sober, pale, and resolute in look. "God protects us, Mr. Fetz," said the landlord, coming first into possession of his customary senses. "What in the universe is all this? These are strange things you've been saying." Fetz turned toward us. He looked us each in succession in the face. "See if you can hold your tongues," said he. "That man McFarland is not safe to cross. Those that have done so already have repented it too late." And then, without so much as finishing his third glass, far less waiting for the other two, he bade us goodbye and went forth, under the lamp of the hotel, into the black night. We three turned to our places in the parlor, with the big red fire and the four clear candles. And as we recapitulated what had passed, the first chill of our surprise soon changed into a glow of curiosity. We sat late. It was the latest session I've known in the Old George. Each man, before we parted, had his theory that he was bound to prove, and none of us had any nearer business in this world than to track out the past of our condemned companion and surprise the secret that he shared with the great London doctor. It is no great boast, but I believe I was better hand at worming out a story than either of my fellows at the George. And perhaps there is now no other man alive who could narrate to you the following and foul, unnatural events. In his young days, Fetz studied medicine in the schools of Edinburgh. He had talent of a kind, the talent that picks up swiftly what it hears and readily retails it for its own. He worked little at home, but he was civil, attentive, and intelligent in the presence of his masters. They soon picked him out as a lad who listened closely and remembered well. Nay, strange as it seemed to me when I first heard it, he was in those days well favored and pleased by his exterior. There was, at that period, a certain extramural teacher of anatomy, whom I shall here designate by the letter K. His name was subsequently too well known. The man who bore it sculled through the streets of Edinburgh in disguise, while the mob that appalled at the execution of Burke called loudly for the blood of his employer. But Mr. K was then at the top of his vogue. He enjoyed a popularity due partly to his own talent and address, partly to the incapacity of his rival, the university professor. The students, at least, swore by his name, and Fetz believed himself and was believed by others to have laid the foundations of success when he had acquired the favor of this metaphorically famous man. Mr. K was a bon vivant, as well as an accomplished teacher. He liked a sly illusion no less than a careful preparation. In both capacities, Fetz enjoyed and deserved his notice, and by the second year of his attendance, he held the half-regular position of second demonstrator or sub-assistant in his class. In this capacity, the charge of the theater and lecture room devolved in particular upon his shoulders. He had to answer for the cleanliness of the premises and the conduct of other students. It was a part of his duty to supply, receive, and divide the various subjects. It was with a view to this last, at that time very delicate, affair that he was lodged by Mr. K in the same wind, and at least in the same building with the dissecting rooms. Here, after a night of turbulent pleasures, his hand still tottering, his sight still misty and confused, he would be called out of bed in the black hours of the winter dawn by the unclean and desperate interlopers who supplied the table. He would open the door to these men, since infamous throughout the land. He would help them with their tragic burden, pay them their sordid price, and remain alone when they were gone with the unfriendly relics of humanity. From such a scene, he would return to snatch another hour or two of slumber to repair the abuses of the night and refresh himself for the labors of the day. Few lads could have been more insensible to the impressions of a life thus passed among the insides of mortality. His mind was closed against all general considerations. He was incapable of interest in the fate and fortunes of another, the slave of his own desires and low ambitions. Cold, light, and selfish, in the last resort, he had that modicum of prudence, miscalled morality, which keeps a man from inconvenient drunkenness or punishable theft. He coveted, besides, a measure of consideration from his masters and his fellow pupils, and he had no desire to fail conspicuously in the external parts of life. Thus he made it his pleasure to gain some distinction in his studies, and day after day rendered unimpeachable eye service to his employer, Mr. K. For his day of work, he indemnified himself by nights of roaring, blackguardly employment. And when that balance had been struck, the organ that called his conscience declared itself content. The supply of subjects was continual trouble to him as well as to his master. In that large and busy glass, the raw material of the anatomist kept perpetually running out, and the business thus rendered necessary was not only unpleasant in itself, but threatened dangerous consequences to all who were concerned. It was the policy of Mr. K to ask no questions in his dealings with the trade. "They bring the body and we pay the price," he used to say, dwelling on the alliteration, "quid pro quo." And again, somewhat profanely, "ask no questions," he would tell his assistants, "for conscience' sake." There was no understanding that the subjects were approved by the crime of murder. Had that idea been broached to him in words, he would have recoiled in horror, but the lightness of his speech upon so grave a matter was in itself an offense against good manners, and a temptation to the men whom he dealt. Fetz, for instance, had often remarked to himself upon the singular freshness of the bodies. He had been struck again and again by the hangdog, abominable looks of the ruffians who came to him before the dawn, and putting things together clearly in his private thoughts, he perhaps attributed a meaning too immoral and too categorical to the unguarded counsels of his master. He understood his duty, in short, to have three branches: to take what was brought, to pay the price, and to avert the eye from any evidence of crime. One November morning, this policy of silence was put sharply to the test. He had been awake all night with a racking toothache, pacing his room like a caged beast or throwing himself in fury on his bed, and had fallen at last into that profound, uneasy slumber that so often follows on a night of pain, when he was awakened by the third or fourth angry repetition of the concerted signal. There was a thin, bright moonshine. It was bitter cold, windy, and frosty. The town had not yet awakened, but an indefinable stir already preluded the noise and businesses of the day. The ghouls had come later than usual, and they seemed more than usually eager to be gone. Fetz, stuck with sleep, lighted them upstairs. He heard their grumbled Irish voices through a dream, and as they stripped the sack from their sad merchandise, he leaned, dozing, with his shoulder propped against the wall. He had to shake himself to find the men their money. As he did so, his eyes lightened on the dead face. He started. He took two steps nearer with the candle raised. "God Almighty," he cried. "That's Shane Galbraith." The man answered nothing, but shuffled nearer the door. "I know her, I tell you," he continued. "She was alive and hearty yesterday. It's impossible she can be dead. It's impossible you should have got this body fairly." "Sure, sir, you're mistaken entirely," said one of the men. But the other looked Fetz darkly in the eyes and demanded the money on the spot. It was impossible to misconceive the threat or to exaggerate the danger. The lad's heart failed him. He stammered some excuses, counted on the sum, and saw his hateful visitors depart. No sooner were they gone than he hastened to confirm his doubts. By a dozen unquestionable marks, he identified the girl he had jested with the day before. He saw, with horrors, marks upon her body that might well betoken violence. A panic seized him, and he took refuge in his room. There he reflected at length over the discovery that he had made, considered soberly the bearing of Mr. K's instructions and the danger to himself of interference in so serious a business, and at last, in sore perplexity, determined to wait for the advice of his immediate superior, the class assistant. This was a young doctor, Wolf McFarland, a high favorite among all the reckless students, clever, dissipated, and unscrupulous to the last degree. He traveled and studied abroad. His manners were agreeable and a little forward. He was an authority on the stage, skillful on the ice or the links with the skate or golf club. He dressed with nice audacity, and to put the finishing touch upon his glory, he kept a gig and a strong trotting horse. With Fetz, he was on terms of intimacy. Indeed, their relative positions called for some community of life, and when subjects were scarce, the pair would drive far into the country in McFarland's gig, visit and desecrate some lonely graveyard, and return before dawn with their booty to the door of the dissecting room. On that particular morning, McFarland arrived somewhat earlier than his wont. Fetz heard him and met him on the stairs, told him his story, and showed him the cause of his alarm. McFarland exclaimed, the marks on her body. "Yes," he said with a nod, "it looks fishy." "Well, what should I do?" asked Fetz. "Do?" repeated the other. "Do you want to do anything? At least as soon as men did, I should say." "Someone else might recognize her," objected Fetz. "She was well known as the Castle Rock." "We'll hope not," said McFarland. "And if anyone does, well, you didn't, don't you see, and there's an end. The fact is, this has been going on too long. Stir up the mud and you'll get K in the most unholy trouble. You'll be in a shocking box yourself. So will I, if you come to that. I should like to know how any one of us would look, or what the devil we should have to say to ourselves in any Christian witness box. For me, you know there's one thing certain, that, practically speaking, all our subjects have been murdered." "McFarland!" cried Fetz. "Come now," sneered the other, "as if you hadn't suspected it yourself." "Suspected is one thing, and proof is another. Yes, I know, and I'm as sorry as you are this should have come here," tapping the body with his cane. "The next best thing to me is to not recognize it. And," he added coolly, "I don't. You may, if you please. I don't dictate, but I think a man of his word would do as I do. And I may add, I fancy this is what K would look at for our hands. The question is, why did he choose us two for his assistants? And I answer, because he didn't want old wives." This was the tone of all others to affect the mind of a lad like Fetz. He agreed to imitate McFarland. The body of the unforgettable girl was duly dissected, and no one remarked or appeared to recognize her. One afternoon, when his day's work was over, Fetz dropped into a popular tavern and found McFarland sitting with a stranger. This was a small man, very pale and dark, with coal black eyes. The cut of his features gave a promise of intellect and refinement, which was but feebly realized in his manners, for he provided upon a near acquaintance, coarse, vulgar, and stupid. He exercised, however, a very remarkable control over McFarland, issued orders like the great Bashaw, became inflamed at the least discussion or delay, and commented rudely on the servility with which he was obeyed. His most offensive person took a fancy to Fett on the spots, piled him with drinks, and honored him with unusual confidences on his past career. If a tenth of the part of what he confessed were true, it was a very loathsome role, and the lad's vanity was tickled by the attention of a so experienced man. "I'm a pretty bad fellow myself," the stranger remarked, "but McFarlane is the boy. Toddy McFarlane, I call him. Toddy, order your friend another glass." Or it might be, "Toddy, you jump and shut the door. Toddy hates me," he said again. "Oh yes, Toddy, you do." "Don't call me that confounded name," growled McFarlane. "Hear him. Did you ever see the lad's blade knife? He would like to do that all over my body," remarked the stranger. "We medicals have a better way than that," said Fetz. "When we dislike a dead friend of ours, we dissect them." McFarlane looked up sharply as though this jest was scarcely to his mind. The afternoon passed. Gray, for that was the stranger's name, invited Fetz to join them at dinner, ordered feasts so sumptuous that the tavern was thrown into commotion, and when all was done, commanded McFarlane to settle the bill. It was late before they separated. The man, Gray, was incapably drunk. McFarlane, sobered by his fury, chewed the cud of the money he had been forced to squander and the sights he had been obliged to swallow. Fetz, with various liquors singing in his head, returned home with devious footsteps and a mind entirely in abeyance. Next day, McFarlane was absent from the class, and Fetz smiled to himself as he imagined him still squiring the intolerable Gray from tavern to tavern. As soon as the hour of liberty had struck, he posted from place to place in quest of his last night's companion. He could find them, however, nowhere, so returned early to his rooms, went early to bed, and slept the sleep of the just. At 4 a.m, he was awakened by the well-known signal. Descending to the door, he was filled with astonishment to find McFarlane with his gig, and in the gig, one of those long and ghastly packages with which he was so well acquainted. "What?" he cried. "Have you been out alone? How did you manage?" But McFarlane silenced him roughly, bidding him turn to business. When they got the body upstairs and laid it on the table, McFarlane made it first as if he were going away. Then he paused and seemed to hesitate, and then, "You'd better look at the face," said he, in tones of some constraint. "You'd better," he repeated as Fetz only stared at him in wonder. "But where and how and when did you come by it?" cried the other. "Look at the face," was his only answer. Fetz was staggered. Strange doubts assailed him. He looked from the young doctor to the body and then back again. At last, with a start, he did as he was bidden. He had almost expected the sight that met his eyes, and yet the shock was cruel. To see, fixed in the rigidity of death and naked on that coarse layer of soap cloth, the man whom he had left well clad and full of meat and sin upon the threshold of a tavern, awoke, even in the thoughtless Fetz, some of the terrors of the conscience. It was a cross to be, which re-echoed in his soul that two whom he had known should have come to lie upon these icy tables. Yet, these were only secondary thoughts. His first concern regarded Wolfe. Unprepared for a challenge so monumentous, he knew not how to look at his comrade in the face. He durst not meet his eye, and he had neither words nor voice at his command. It was McFarlane himself who had made the first advance. He came up quietly behind and laid his hand gently but firmly on the other's shoulder. "Richardson," said he, "may have the head." Now Richardson was a student who had long been anxious for that portion of the human subject to dissect. There was no answer, and the murder resumed. "Talking of business, you must pay me. Your accounts, you see, must tally." Fetz found a voice, the ghost of his own. "Pay you?" he cried. "Pay you for that?" "Why, yes, of course, you must. By all means and on every possible account, you must," returned the other. "I dare not give it for nothing. You dare not take it for nothing. It would compromise us both." This is another case like Jane Galbraith's. The more things are wrong, the more we just act as if it were all right. Where does old Kay keep his money? There, answered Fats hoarsely, pointing to a cupboard in the corner. Give me the key, then, said the other calmly, holding out his hand. There was an instant's hesitation, and the die was cast. Garland cannot suppose a nervous twitch, the infinitesimal mark of an immense relief, and he felt the key between his fingers. He opened the cupboard, brought out pen and ink and paper book that stood in one compartment, and separated from the funds in a drawer, a sum suitable to the occasion. Now look here, he said. There is the payment made, first proof of your good faith, first step to your security. You now have to clinch it by a second. Enter the payment in your book, and then, for your part, you may defy the devil. The next few seconds were for Fats an agony of thought, but in balancing his terrors, it was the most immediate that triumphed. Any future difficulty seemed almost welcome if he could avoid a present quarrel with McFarlane. He set down the candle which he had been carrying all this time, and with a steady hand entered the date, the nature, and the amount of the transaction. And now, said McFarlane, it's only fair that you should pocket the lucre. I've had my share already. By the by, when a man of word falls into a bit of luck, has a few shillings extra in his pocket, I'm ashamed to speak of it, but there's a rule of conduct in this case. No treating, no purchase of expensive class books, no squaring of old bets. Borrow, don't lend. McFarlane, began Fats, still somewhat hoarsely, I've put my neck in a halter to oblige you. To oblige me? Cried Wolfe. Oh, come. You did, as near as I can see, the matter of what you were downright had to do in self-defense. Suppose I got into trouble where you would be. The second little matter flows clearly from the first, Mr. Gray, is the continuation of Miss Galbraith. You can't begin and then stop. If you begin, you must keep on beginning. That's the truth. No rest for the wicked. A horrible sense of blackness and treachery of fate seized hold upon the soul of the unhappy student. My God, he cried, but what have I done, and when did I begin? To be made a class assistant, in the name of reason, where's the harm in that? Service wanted the position, Service might have got it. Would he have been where I am now? My dear fellow, said McFarlane, what a boy you are. What harm has come to you? What harm can come to you if you hold your tongue? Why, man, do you know what this life is? There are two squads of us, the lions and the lambs. If you're a lamb, you'll come to lie upon these tables like Gray or Jane Galbraith. If you're a lion, you'll live and drive a horse like me, like Kay, like all the world, with any wit or courage. You're staggered at the first, but look at Kay. My dear fellow, you're clever, you have pluck. I like you, and Kay likes you. You were born to lead the hunt, and I tell you, on my honor and my experience of life, 3 days from now, and you'll laugh at all these scarecrows like a high school boy at a farce. And with that, McFarlane took his departure and drove up the wind and his gang to get cover before daylight. Fetz was thus left alone with his regrets. He saw the miserable peril in which he stood involved. He saw with inexpressible dismay that there was no limit to his weakness, and that, from concession to concession, he'd fallen from the arbiter of McFarland's destiny to his paid and helpless accomplice. He would have given the world to have been a little braver at the time, but it did not occur to him that he might still be brave. The secret of Jane Galbraith and the cursed entry in the day book closed his mouth. Hours passed. The class began to arrive. The members of the unhappy Gray were dealt out one and to another and received without remark. Richardson was made happy with the head, and before the hour of freedom rang, Fats trembled with exultation to perceive how far they had already gone toward safety. For 2 days he continued to watch, with increasing joy, the dreadful process of disguise. On the third day, McFarland made his appearance. He had been ill, he said, but he made up for lost time by the energy with which he directed the students. To Richardson in particular, he extended the most valuable assistance and advice, and that student, encouraged by the praise of the demonstrator, burned high with ambitious hopes and saw that the medal already in his grasp. Before the week was out, McFarland's prophecy had been fulfilled. Fetz had outlived his terrors and had forgotten his baseness. He began to plume himself upon his courage and had so arranged the story in his mind that he could look back on these events with an unhealthy pride. Of his accomplice, he saw but little. They met, of course, in the business of the class. They received their orders together from Mr. K. At times, they had a word or two in private, and McFarland was, from first to last, particularly kind and jovial. But it was plain that he avoided any reference to their common secret, and even when Fats whispered to him that he had cast in his lot with the lions and forsworn the lambs, he only signed him smilingly to hold his peace. At length an occasion arose which threw the pair once more into closer union. Mr. K was again short of subjects. Pupils were eager, and it was a part of this teacher's pretensions to always be well supplied. At the same time, there came the news of a burial in the rusted graveyard of Glencourse. Time had little changed the place in question. It stood then, as now, upon a crossroad out of all human habitations and buried fathom deep into the foliage of 6 cedar trees. The cries of the sheep upon the neighboring hills, the streamlets upon either hand, one loudly singing among pebbles, the other dripping fruitively from pond to pond, the stir of the wind in mountainous old flowering chestnuts, and once in 7 days the voice of the bell and the old tune of the precentor were the only sounds that disturbed the silence around the rural church. The resurrection man, to use a byname of the period, was not to be deterred by any of the sanctities of customary piety. It was part of his trade to despise and desecrate the scrolls and trumpets of old tombs, the paths worn by the feet of worshippers and mourners, and the offerings and the inscriptions of bereaved affection. To rustic neighborhoods where love is more than commonly tenacious, and where some bonds of blood or fellowship unite the entire society of parish, the body snatcher, far from being repelled by a natural aspect, was attracted by the ease and safety of the task. To bodies that had been laid in earth in joyful expectation of a far different awakening, there came that hastily lamp-lit, terror-haunted resurrection of the spade and mattock. The coffin was forced, the cremains torn, and the melancholy relics clad in sackcloth, after being rattled for hours on moonless byways, were at length exposed to uttermost indignities before a class of gaping boys. Somewhat as two vultures may swoop upon a dying lamb, Fats and McFarland were to be let loose upon a grave in that green and quiet resting place. The wife of a farmer, a woman who had lived for 60 years and been known for nothing but good butter and godly conversation, was to be rooted from her grave at midnight and carried dead and naked to that faraway city that she had always honored with her Sunday's best. The place beside her family was to be empty till the crack of doom, her innocent and almost vulnerable members to be exposed to the last curiosity of the anatomist. Late one afternoon, the pair set forth, well wrapped in cloaks and furnished with a formidable bottle. It rained with remission, a cold, dense, lashing rain. Now and again, there blew a puff of wind, but these sheets of falling water kept it down. Bottle and all, it was a sad and silent drive, as far as Benicuik, where they were to spend the evening. They stopped once to hide their implements in a thick bush not far from the churchyard, and once again at the fisher's tryst, to have a toast before the kitchen fire and vary their nips of whiskey with a glass of ale. When they reached their journey's end, the gig was housed, the horse was fed and comforted, and the two young doctors in a private room sat down to the best dinner and the best wine the house afforded. The lights, the fire, the beating rain upon the window, the cold, incredulous work that lay before them added zest to their enjoyment of the meal. With every glass, their cordiality increased. Soon McFarland handed a little pile of gold to his companion. "A compliment," he said. Between friends, these little accommodations ought to fly like pipe lights. Fetz pocketed the money and applauded the sentiment to the echo. "You're a philosopher," he cried. "It was an ass till I knew you. You and Kay between you, by the Lord Harry. But you'll make a man of me." "Of course we shall," applauded McFarlane. "A man? I tell you it required a man to back me up the other morning. There are some big brawling 40-year-old cowards who would have turned sick at the look of the dead thing. But not you. You kept your head. I watched you." Well, and why not? Fetz thus vaunted himself. "It was no affair of mine. There was nothing to gain on the side but disturbance, and on the other I could count on your gratitude, don't you see?" And he slapped his pocket till the gold pieces rang. McFarlane somehow felt a certain touch of alarm at these unpleasant words. He may have regretted that he taught his young companion so successfully, but he had no time to interfere, for the others noisily continued in this boastful strain. "The great thing is to not be afraid. Now, between you and me, I don't want to hang. That's practical. But for all cant, McFarlane, I was born with a contempt. Hell, God, devil, right, wrong, sin, crime, and all the old galley of curiosities. They may frighten boys, but men of the world, like you and me, despise them. Here's to the memory of Gray." It was by this time growing somewhat late. The gig, according to the order, was brought round to the door with both lamps brightly shining, and the young men had to pay their bill and take the road. They announced that they were bound for Peebles, and drove in that direction till they were clear of the last houses of the town. Then, extinguishing the lamps, returned upon their course, and followed by a road toward Glencourse. There was no sound but that of their own passage, and the incessant strident pouring of the rain. It was pitch dark here, and there a white gate or white stone in the wall guided them for a short space across the night. But for the most part, it was at a foot pace, and almost groping, that they'd picked their way through the resonant blackness of their solemn and isolated destination. In the sunken woods that traversed the neighborhood of the burying ground, the last glimmer failed them, and it became necessary to kindle a match and re-illuminate one of the lanterns of the gig. Thus, under the dripping trees, and environed by huge and moving shadows, they reached the scene of their unhallowed labors. They were both experienced in such affairs, and powerful with the spade, and they had scarce been 20 minutes at their task before they were rewarded by a dull rattle on the coffin lid. At the same moment, McFarlane, having hurt his hand upon the stone, flung it carelessly above his head. The grave in which they now stood, almost to the shoulders, was close to the edge of the plateau of the graveyard, and the gig lamp had been propped, the better to illuminate the labors against the tree, and on the immediate verge of the steep bank descending to the stream. Chance had taken a sure aim with the stone. Then came a clang of broken glass. Night fell upon them. Sounds alternately dull and ringing announced the bounding of the lantern down the bank and its occasional collision with the trees. A stone or two, which it had dislodged in its descent, rattled behind it to the profundities of the glen, and then silence, like night, resumed its sway. And then they might bend their hearing to its utmost pitch, but naught was to be heard except the rain, now marching to the wind, now steadily falling over miles of open country. They were so nearly at an end of their arbored task that they judged it wisest to complete it in the dark. The coffin was exhumed and broken open, the body inserted into the dripping sack, and carried between them to the gig, one mounted to keep it in place, and the other, taking the horse by the mouth, groped along by wall and bush until they reached the wider road at the Fisher's Tryst. It was a faint, diffused radiancy which they hailed like daylight. By that they pushed the horse to a good place and began to rattle along merrily in the direction of the town. They had both been wetted to the skin during their operations, and now, as the gig jumped among the deep ruts, the thing that stood propped between them fell now upon one and now upon the other, At every repetition of the horrid contact, each instinctively repelled it with greater haste, and the process, natural although it was, began to tell upon the nerves of the companions. McFarlane made some ill-favored jest about the farmer's wife, but it came hollowly from his lips and was allowed to drop in silence. Still, their unnatural burden bumped from side to side, and now the head would be laid as if in confidence upon their shoulders, and now the drenching sackcloth would flap icily about their faces. A creeping chill began to possess the soul of Fetz. He peered at the bundle, and it seemed somehow larger than at first. All over the countryside, and from every degree of distance, the farm dogs accompanied their passage with tragic ululations. And it grew and grew upon his mind that some unnatural miracle had been accomplished, that some nameless change had been following the dead body, and that it was in fear of their unholy burden that the dogs were howling. "For God's sake," said he, making a great effort to arrive at speech. "For God's sake, let's have a light." Seemingly, McFarlane was affected in the same direction, for though he made no reply, he stopped the horse, passed the reins to his companion, got down, and proceeded to kindle the remaining lamp. They had by that time gone no farther than the crossed road down Ashlandly. The rain still poured as though the deluge were returning, and it was no easy matter to make a light in such a world of wet and darkness. When at last the flickering blue flame had been transferred to the wick and began to expand and clarify and shed a wide circle of misty brightness around the gig, it became possible for the two young men to see each other and the thing that they had along with them. The rain had molded the rough sacking to the outlines of the body underneath. The head was distinct from the trunk, the shoulders plainly modeled. Something at once spectral and human riveted their eyes upon the ghastly comrade of their drive. For some time, McFarlane stood motionless, holding up the lamp. A nameless dread was swathed like a wet sheet about the body and tightened the white skin upon the face of Fence. A fear that was meaningless, a horror of what could not be, kept mounting to his brain. Another beat of the watch, and he'd spoken, but his comrade forestalled him. "This is not a woman," said McFarlane in a hushed voice. "It was a woman when we put her in," whispered Fetz. "Hold that lamp," said the other. "I must see her face." And as Fetz took the lamp, his companion untied the fastenings of the sack and drew down the cover from the head. The light fell very clear upon the dark, well-molded features and smooth-shaven cheeks of a too familiar countenance, often beheld in dreams of both of these young men. A wild yell rang up into the night. Each leaped from his own side into the roadway. The lamp fell, broke, and was extinguished. And the horse, terrified by this unusual commotion, bounded and went off toward Edinburgh at gallop, bearing along with it, sole occupant of the gig, the body of the dead and long dissected, Gray. Hello, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the stories tonight. These two were really, really fun to read. They were very, very interesting. First thing I've ever read from Bram Stoker, and first thing I've ever read from the other author that is just slipping my mind at the moment. I will say, and I hope it's not too obvious as you're listening, the second one was quite difficult for me. Something about the verbiage, something about the writing style, it was a lot for me. And I'm noticing that with a lot of these public domain stories, these older stories, but it's such a challenge, but in a good way. And I want to continue doing them because I do think it's challenging, but it's also fun to do something different and to try something that I haven't really ever given much thought to. So let me know which one you liked more in the comment section below. Leave me some suggestions for more in the comment section below as well. And as you're doing that, I will thank all of the $5 patrons and members. So thank you to Absinthe Alice, Amethyst, Amet, Ann Berry, Bubbly Panda, Caroline, Christina Smith, CT, Deborah Tychus, Elizabeth Watkins, LSG, Frankie Brockway, Furious Weasel, If in Doubt Flat Out, Jennifer Dameron, Jesse Jess, Justinia Zaromski, Karen Parrott, Kat, Kathy Flanning, Kelly Sprague, Laura, Lindsay Pruitt, Melody Evans, Melissa Berwick, Mindy Bannon, Moon Potato, Nicholas Moore, Nora, Nova Nocturne, Patricia Rodea, PJ Masks, Ray Clegg, Sentinel, The Neon Golem 24, Tiger Princess, Tish Love, Triumph, and Victoria Stepp. I swear that list just continues to get longer and longer, and I really, really appreciate all the continued support from everyone. It's really, really awesome. And of course, thank you to everyone who stops by and watches the videos, leaves a like, leaves a comment, says something nice. I appreciate you all as well, just the same. I hope you all have a wonderful day, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are. Take care of yourselves and everyone around you. And as always, stay safe out there.